My name's Maureen. I'm an alcoholic.
Morning.
I'm surprised you came, Brian. You've heard my story a million times. Somebody from my home group is on Zoom. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Billy, for asking me to speak. I'm always honored to be of service at any AA meeting, and this one, I know from one of my old home groups. A lot of people found this meeting a great opportunity to be of service, and so it's, in that way, near and dear to my heart. So thank you. Let's see. My sobriety date is October 8th of 1988. My home group is Back Alley, which it meets on Thursday nights in Frederick, Maryland. And I'm just going to tell you, I have a sponsor. I'm really glad to be here. So let's see. Let's start at the beginning, I guess. I started drinking when I was very young. Started drinking when I was 11. And I, my sister gave me my first real drink. I mean, I'd had, sips of beer and whatnot, but I'm talking about my first real drink, not, sneaking around what I could get away with, but, like a partial bottle, couple fingers, I guess, but that's a lot when you're 11, of Southern Comfort. Given to me by my sister as a bribe so that I would leave her and her boyfriend alone. I happily took it, drank it all. As a child, I was never a very good liar. I had a tell. You could always, I'm not going to tell you what it was. My husband knows, unfortunately, but as soon as I took that first drink, I didn't have that tell anymore. I just immediately, somehow lying came quite naturally to me after that. I remember my mother came home, and I didn't want to, get caught. So I basically just said I wasn't feeling good, and I lied to her. She took me at my word. I didn't let her get too close to me. I went and laid down in my bed. I had no consequences. I didn't have any real consequences for a very long time. Well, not that long actually, because I was a teenage drunk. So when you're a teenage drunk, it's pretty easy, so I think I was a pretty typical teenage drunk. I mean, really, I had two parents that worked, so I pretty much started drinking and a few other things. I was telling Billy before that didn't really have a big, I don't really have a lot of drugs in my story. But there is a part that relates that is going to have to come. But, I was what I would call opportunistic. So whatever came into the house, I was happy to take it. But I can tell you that, if I had a choice, a drink would always be my choice. I'm a true blue alcoholic. And it gave me the desired effect, which was that I didn't feel anything. I was such an uncomfortable child. I was always very painfully shy, and this was my solution, and it worked very well. A little too well, because then I got a little overly familiar with people who I had no business being overly familiar with. And I became that teenage girl who definitely would sleep with your boyfriend, who would definitely, unapologetically do a whole lot of things that I had no business doing. And then what happened was I ended up getting arrested when I was 14. It's funny, I've only been arrested twice, and they were both for smoking pot, which is something that I never even really liked to do. It's just one of those things that, like I said, if you offered it to me, the answer was always yes. But I didn't actually like it. So I got arrested for smoking pot at school, and that kind of just went away. I don't really even remember. Community service, something, something, I don't remember. But then a couple of years later, I got arrested again, but this was a little more serious because I don't think I had done anything. Like, I was primarily a drinker. I hadn't, but I was out with my really good friend and her boyfriend. We're in a park sitting in a car, really smart. And I said, "This is a bad idea. We shouldn't be here," and they said, "It's fine, it's fine." And then, the next thing I know, the spotlights are coming, are on, and the car driving towards us. And so we all got, handcuffed and taken away. And it turned out I got arrested for intent to distribute because, my best friend's boyfriend was a dealer. And so, Yeah, so that was a little bit, I had a little more consequence from that. And so what they did was they sent me to NA, which is really strange because, I was just shy. It was just before I turned 17, and I'm going to these meetings, and I have to go because I have to get my slip signed. And I just thought, what the F am I doing here? This is, and I went, and I didn't relate to any of it. I was, it was mostly a bunch of old bikers that were talking about being drunks and junkies and all this stuff. And I was just like, what? But I had to go, and I kept going. And this was in the spring of 1984. And I remember, there being a few young people then, and so here I am, I'm 17, and these guys are mostly not 17. And but there was a couple of guys who befriended me, and they took me to an AA club, and I walked into that AA club for the first time, and there was just something, and I can't describe it other than to say I knew that these were my people. It was like I walked in and I was like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. And I don't know why. I just walked into the room. I hadn't even heard anybody share yet, but somehow I knew right away. And yet I still had reservations about whether or not I was an alcoholic. So I would go to these meetings, and I would go once a week to this NA meeting so I could get my slip signed. And then I would go out afterwards, and I would, drink and, hang out with my friends and do all the things I'd, had been doing all along, and, continuing to wreak havoc in the lives of my friends and family. And I, but I enjoyed being in AA. I kind of wanted to be there. I wanted this to be, the thing for me, and yet I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. So it was almost like, like looking for a community that really that I didn't belong to. And yet I did. Because I was not a light case. I was not a light case alcoholic. You can be a real bad alcoholic and still have some pretty heavy reservations. And you probably all have had that experience. The next thing that happened that changed the course of my life was I was sitting in an AA meeting in this club, and in walked my future higher power, or actually my immediate higher power. I in walked this guy, this devil may care chap who came swaggering in with a cowboy hat and boots on, and he was, clearly too old for me. Clearly, somebody my mother wouldn't be happy for me to bring home, and I was like, I must make him mine. And so, and I don't even know. I mean, I guess I was maybe 6 months sober or something like that, so I mean, long story short, it's that guy. So ultimately things worked out okay. He so I started dating this guy, and immediately made him my higher power. Just immediately, because I didn't really have a program. I didn't have anything. I wasn't doing anything other than coming to meetings. And then I was going to dances, and I was making friends, and I was doing all these social things, which was very common in the 80s where I got sober. There was a lot of activity. There's a lot of fun things to do. And I got swept up in that, but I wasn't really a member, I was a visitor, I was testing it out. And so, when my boyfriend at the time, came home, he came to pick me up because we were supposed to go to a meeting together. And he said, "Well, I drank last night, and I'm going to go to the bar, and I'll drop you off at the meeting on my way." And well, isn't that nice? But I didn't hesitate. I didn't think, "Is this a good idea?" I just said, "No, I'll go with you. It's fine." I had no defense against that first drink because I didn't have a higher power. I didn't have anything. I had, I had friends. They were great, but they were never going to keep me sober. And so, I proceeded to follow my boyfriend in and out of meetings. And we would drink together, and then one of us would get sober, and then the other would follow, and then one of us would drink and then the other would follow. And we went on like that for a while. So then we decided to get married. And I think it was largely because his mother would no longer let me spend the night at their house because she thought it was a bad example. He had two children at the time, two small children, and she thought it wasn't a good example for the children for us to be, like spending the night together out of wedlock. So I was like, well, there's a solution for that. So we got married, and here I am playing house with this terrible alcoholic, being also a terrible alcoholic. Falls kind of under the category of what was I thinking? But the reality was I wasn't thinking. I mean, when you're, an alcoholic in whose cups is an unlovely creature, and that was me. I wasn't capable of making a good decision to save my life. And I mean, we had the pretty, what you would expect. We never were, we never actually hit each other, but with our words, and we never, we had, some broken furniture, but we never, I mean, it was just crazy. It was like a, made for TV movie about alcoholism. So eventually, I'd been coming for a long time, and I just, I mean, I go to meetings and I try to be, a part of this thing, and there just was a disconnect, and I just kept building on my story, I just kept doing these crazy, outrageous things. I just kept, I remember at one point we were living with my in-laws, and I had a baby, and he was going to meetings, and I was not sober, but his family didn't know that, and I couldn't really drink at the house. So I would put my baby in the car and drive around with her so that I could drink because I couldn't drink at home. And I'd kind of forgotten about that. And I was like, oh, I never drove with my kids drunk. And I was just like, shit, yes, I did. Yes, I did. Because I had no other option, I had to drink. And so, there's a lot of, back and forth stuff that happened. But then eventually I just, one night, this was the night of my last drink. My husband was sober at the time, or at least he was going to a meeting. It's all kind of a blur, honestly. I was home, and I had a bottle on the nightstand next to my bed, and I knew he was leaving, and I had a baby that was 6 months old, and a 2-year-old, or actually her birthday was the next day, she turned two. And I knew it wasn't going to be enough. So I kind of panicked, and I was like, well, wait, let me just go to the store before you leave, because and I didn't even say so I could get alcohol. He just looked at me, he said, why? So you can get more booze. And I was flustered, and I didn't know how to respond. And so he just looked at me and said, he said, you're fucking drunk. And he turned around and left me and went to the meeting. And I was like, at first it was like, it was more than just the sting of a slap. It felt like he'd punched me, his words hit me so hard. And then I just sat there, and then I got like goosebumps because I just said to myself, and I said this out loud, and I swear, I went to meetings for 4.5 years, and I came in these rooms, and I'd sit in these rooms, and I'd say, my name's Maureen, I'm an alcoholic, repeatedly, because that's what you did here, it's what people were doing, and I just wanted to fit in. But I never said it at any time where I felt it and I knew it to be true. And in this moment, alone with the bottle on the nightstand next to me, I said, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. And I knew for real, for the first time, coming to meetings consistently for 4.5 years, that I was an alcoholic. I knew. And I couldn't, once I knew, I could never I've never been able to unknow it. Thank God. And I started to cry, and I was crying, not because I was upset by it. I was crying because I was so relieved Because I'd been fighting and coming here and struggling and, constantly going back to drinking, and I didn't know what I was doing wrong and I didn't understand. I didn't even know that I had reservations. I just knew I was coming and trying to do this thing, but I wasn't doing this thing. Number one, I had reservations. So, but I was doing the surface things. There was no substance to anything that I was doing. And, but there was never going to be until I really knew that I was an alcoholic. Because for me, anyway, this is of course just my experience, but for me, I needed to believe that in order for this to be the solution for me, So in this moment, when I was laying in bed crying tears of relief, I knew that this was my solution. I was like, oh, thank God, now this is really finally my solution, and this is what's been missing. And in that same moment, I made a decision that I was coming back, and I knew that I was going to be able to get sober here. And so for me, that moment, just that moment, laying there in bed, with tears streaming down my face, I really went through basically a rudimentary first three steps. And it was enough. It was enough to get me in the, to make me a member. That was when I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, but I had been sober for a little bit before this last relapse, and I'd had some sobriety, and I was had gone back out. And there's a story behind that, but I don't really want to tell it. If you really want to hear it, it's kind of funny. I'll tell it to you after. But I had a lot of shame about, not having stayed sober. So I thought, how am I going to be able to go back to meetings? Maybe no one noticed that I hadn't been coming for 4 months, I mean, we have these thoughts, like maybe nobody missed me. Maybe I can just go back and pretend that I still have the sobriety that I had when I went out. And and I went to meetings under this delusion for a month. It was more painful than drinking. I'll tell you what, it was more painful than drinking. And I remember I was at this young people's meeting in Kensington on a Tuesday night, and it was a pretty big meeting for the time. And I, at the end of the meeting, the leader said, are there any burning desires? And I stood up. It was just one of those, now or never moments. It was that, on the edge of a knife, and I was, and I was like, I gotta do it. I stood up and I said, my name's Maureen and I'm an alcoholic and I have 30 days. And I cried, and I was, and I, because I still had so much shame about it, and I thought, everyone's gonna reject me. I mean, we have this narrative in our head that's so false, that, no one's gonna welcome us if we mess up, and I don't know, I know this is a church and I probably shouldn't cuss, but I think of AA as being very fuck up friendly place. So, and if you are worried, if you're new or if you, have made mistakes that you don't want to own up to, whether it's relapsing or something else, I'll tell you, that night, being able to have that moment of honesty was that the first night that I put down the drink. Well, actually, I didn't put down the drink. I finished the bottle, quite frankly, and so my sobriety date is my daughter's birthday. But that was my first surrender. And that night in that meeting, when I stood up and I said that I had 30 days, that was my second surrender. And I think that one was of equal importance, because I think if I hadn't had that, been able to have that measure of honesty, I wouldn't be here today. And so, so I got in the middle. I had a sponsor at the time. My first sponsor was, to me, you hear people say, we get sober on the backs of giants. And this my first sponsor, well, my technically my first sponsor was a woman, but she definitely did me dirty. And she, gave me she did something that made me, think, I it's been confirmed, I can't trust women. I just can't trust women. And so, which isn't true, by the way. So if you're wondering, that actually isn't true. But there are people that you can't trust. And I mean, there are plenty of really sick people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I mean, that's an un, it's like it just kind of goes with the territory. But so I had a man sponsor me for the first 5 years that I was sober, and his name was Frank Bonetti, and he was to me, people thought he was, a grumpy old man. He was a big teddy bear. He honestly was. And I call him my spiritual kindergarten teacher. He gave me all the best one-liners. He taught me so many things about, just the fundamentals of sobriety. He was very kind to me. But I also remember the first thing that he said to me was, "You're not allowed to talk about Billy." And I was like, "What? He th Don't you realize he's the problem? I mean, I don't, like, and but I mean, these are the hard lessons that you have to learn here, and it was really great. He just There's just so many things that he did for me that just, really set me up for success. So he sponsored me for a while, and then I kind of started to drift, and I had so when I had a few years of sobriety, I ended up, having a period where I, moved. I'd been living with my mother-in-law yet again, because my husband was a terrible alcoholic also, and not sober at the time. And I moved back in with my parents because I couldn't stand living with my in-laws. They were very generous people, but it's your in-laws. Nobody wants to live with their in-laws. So I moved back to my with my three small children. I moved back to my parents' house, and I just didn't want to be there. And I love my parents, and it was a great place for my kids to live for those 2 years that I lived there. But I just kept thinking, it's temporary, it's temporary. This is just a temporary thing. And so I didn't make that my home, and I didn't go to meetings up there. I still came to, maybe one meeting a week. I would drive down to Montgomery County from Frederick County, which was, probably 45 minutes, to go to one meeting a week. And I wasn't really using my sponsor anymore. And I just sort of got really far off the beam, And so after a couple of years, I moved back in with my husband, and we were living, together again in Montgomery County, which is where I spent most of my, where I got sober and spent most of my sobriety. And so I'm back with my husband, which I'm really happy about, and he's sober, which I'm really happy about. But I'm not really working with a sponsor. I'm not really in the middle. I'm not really doing any step work, but I had done all of the steps. So, it's like I somehow deluded myself into thinking I've got this, So I go to meetings. People would ask me to lead on a step or whatever. I could talk about a step. I've done a step. I've done the eight step. I've done the, I could talk about it till I'm blue in the face. But I wasn't doing it. I hadn't done it. It didn't mean anything to me. It was just, old news, And so I wasn't really an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't really have a connection with a higher power. It was almost fatal, and I went on like that for several years. And then when I was sober, 12 years maybe. Let's see. Yeah, I think 12 years. I'm living with my husband. I'm really unhappy. I think he's pretty unhappy with me too, and I'm just, feeling like, a friend of mine calls it looking for the zipper. I'm feeling so uncomfortable in my skin. I'm looking for a way out of it, And so at that moment, I was really, really ill prepared for what happened next, I came home from work one night, and I got the word that my stepson, who was in college in Colorado, was missing. And, my husband had gone to a meeting with one of his friends because that's what you do when you get, that kind of news. So they immediately went to a meeting, and I came home and waited for him to come back. And we got on the phone, started making calls, and then jumped in the car and, hit the road for Colorado. And we were there for a week before they found his body. And, I mean, we leaned into each other a little bit and cried a lot, but I had no, I was back to looking for a way to not feel, I was back to that place that I had been in when I first started drinking, where I was looking for a way not to have to feel. And I didn't drink, but I thought about it. But I acted out very badly in ways that were, I think, an attempt to anesthetize myself, you know? And after a year, I asked my husband to move out and just continued to spiral and behave badly. And in some ways, I think neglect and harm my children, because I just, I didn't want to have to do what it took to cope with any of this. I just wanted it to just, I wanted it to just disappear, And so my coping skill was to do nothing, I just acted like everything was fine, everything was normal, But I didn't have a sponsor, I didn't have an AA program, and I was again jumping out of my skin. And at the time, I was going to this small women's meeting that was my home group. And I loved that meeting, and it still goes on. It's no longer, it was in this woman's house for many years, and then she sold the house and moved away. And then briefly, it was at my house until I moved into a church. And now that meeting, which is still going on, is my daughter's home group. And my daughter has 13 years of sobriety. So that's, yeah, that's pretty miraculous. But that meeting definitely saved my life many times. But at the time, I was in that jumping off place where I couldn't imagine life with alcohol or without it, And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do here, But I was just like, gripping my chair and white knuckling it and rocking back and forth, like, I just was so uncomfortable. And, I remember one night I was at my home group, and, there was a woman there who, ironically, I had been her first sponsor, and then I drank. And this was back when I, had my last run of 4 months. And so she's in the meeting, and she's going through all these things where she's, had, helped her mother go through her end of life. And she then her husband, who'd been long time sober, drank, and they were having, now going through a divorce, and just all these things that were just kind of ugly. But she wasn't doing what I did. She was using her sponsor, and she was talking about it, talking about the solution out of the book. And she was in the middle, and she was going through it with this grace and this dignity that I just didn't recognize, because I didn't know how to do that. Here I was at that time, I guess I was like 14 years sober, and I was like, something like that. And I was like, I don't know how to do that, And I said, but that's what I want. That's what I want. I don't necessarily expect adversity to go away, but I want to be able to go through it sober, and I want to be able to go through it with a solution. And so after the meeting, we were walking out to our car, and I stopped her, and I took her by the hand, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, "Will you help me?" And I swear you would have thought I was asking her to marry me, because I was just so nervous, And but you know what? She was delighted, to help me. And she's still my sponsor to this day. So, I mean, she, gave me her 20-year chip when I had 20 years, and she gave, I mean, she's still a big part of my life. We're big lovers of live music, and we do that a lot. And so we have a great relationship. But I had to, have another one of those moments of surrender where I had, to sit down with her and just divulge a lot of information, a lot of honesty, of a lot of bad behavior, and a lot of ugliness, and a lot of things that I'd been, destructive things I'd been doing. And and I put it all out there, because I had to. I didn't want to. I didn't want to say the things that I'd been doing, the harms that I'd been causing, but I had to. And and that's definitely saved my life, And what I understood after that was that I can't just come in here and do the steps once and then be like, okay, now I'm done. Now I'll just carry the message to people. But I mean, you can't transmit what you haven't got. So if I'm not continuously, if I'm not living a program of continuous action, then I don't have anything to transmit. And so I learned that I had to continuously do this thing, and that I had to give it away. So that's what I did. We went through the steps, and and I hadn't sponsored anybody in a while, and I started sponsoring people, but I got in the middle, and and at one point, my My husband and I, we got back together. It's been a long, hard road, but I think, we love each other, and we're done with all that shenanigans. So I'm glad about that. And we, we built a life where, people used to call our house the St. Dennis home for wayward alcoholics, because we would have, people that nobody else wanted to talk to come and sleep on our sofa, or sleep on the futon in the basement, or, I mean, for me, my primary purpose is to help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. So, well, to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. But I think they go hand in hand. And so that's the life that we built. And, I started in, I want to say, 2000, fall of 2003, 2004, 2004. I started a women's vegetarian potluck, and I had women come to my house every Tuesday night. We would have a potluck, and then we would go to a meeting. And I did that for 16 years. I did it until the pandemic, and I moved three times during that time. And through all of those moves, they followed me and continued to come to my potluck. And that also saved my life. There were days where I would be coming home from work, and I'd think, oh, the women are coming, and I'll be like, well, now I got to get myself together, and is the house clean, and oh my God. And I'd get home, and I'd get in the door, and maybe 10 or 15 minutes later, they'd start coming in, and I'd be like, the women are here, and I mean, it was just, my whole attitude would immediately shift, and I would be so grateful, and they would be so grateful. And I still have women who tell me, years later, that they came, and it was the first place that they went where they felt like they could actually, have relationships with women, and from my beginnings of believing that you couldn't trust women, this was a really important step in my recovery. And so anyway, so I had that for a long time, I had that until the pandemic. And I had, most of the people that I've sponsored over the years have, moved on, moved away, not relapsed, but, I'm like, fly, little bird, they've gone on to, have lives and done other things, and, and moved to different areas. And I don't need to sponsor somebody that's living in Kentucky. I need to sponsor somebody that I can sit down with face to face, And so, and that's what I do today. Then I guess, well, 13 years ago, my daughter, who I knew was an alcoholic because she was, she was, I'm not going to tell her story, but she, I just knew the evidence when she was in high school and when she was in college. And then she kind of had her, it all culminated when she was in grad school, and she ended up having to come home, and, after a severe mental illness crisis. And she didn't want to be an alcoholic either. She didn't want to, she actually just spoke for Billy's anniversary last Saturday night and did a fantastic job, and sometimes listening to her story, while it's painful, I'm so grateful, I'm so grateful. Like I said, her home group is now my, the home group that I when she came back to live with us, I brought her to that meeting because I knew it was a gentle, nurturing meeting. And so she came to that meeting for a while, and I could tell that, once she really did get sober, because there was a little, rough start, but once she really did get sober, that this was the meeting for her. And so I knew that while this had been my meeting for quite a few years and had been a great life-saving home group to me, I just kind of slowly backed out of it because I wanted to, I wanted it to be hers. And so, and I think that that was the right thing to do too, because it's really easy when it's your family members to want to micromanage it and be like, I mean, hell, I wanted to pick her sponsor, I wanted to do it, you know what I mean? I was like, let me tell you how to do it, but you can't do that for your daughter, you can't do that, And so I'm grateful to have had, the wherewithal to do that, because it's really hard. And so during, fast forward to the pandemic, you know, I'm involved, I have a sponsor, I have sponsor, you know, I'm doing all the things, and you know, and then all of a sudden I can't go to a meeting. And then all of a sudden, you know, I can't have people over for veg chicks, and all of a sudden I don't know what the hell to do. And but thankfully there were a lot of very industrious people who put some shit together real quick, you know, because you know, I did go to some meetings on Zoom. I didn't love them, but I did them because I knew I needed to stay connected, you know. And once I was able to, I mean, I was the first person who was ready to sit in a parking lot in a chair in a big circle with people with masks on, because I was like, I need people, and I need to be able to lay eyes on them. I need to be in person. And I love Zoom as an option when necessary, but for me, I need that human connection, you know, because the human connection is how I make my connection with my higher power. You know, and so over the years, that's definitely changed a lot. I you know, came in here, you know, sort of a wayward Catholic, and you know, with a very loose belief, and wasn't balking at the idea of God. But today, I only call my higher power God, you know, in name, because it's recognizable to you know, the general public. But to me, it's probably a little different than most people's, you know, and that's fine. But I believe it, and it's a power that keeps me sober. But the important thing for me isn't just to have one, but to stay connected to it, you know. And so for me, I've learned that I have to do all of these steps every day. You know, like I said, you know, I went through a period where I was sober for a long time and I didn't do jack, you know. You know, today, I like to say my watchword is vigilance, you know, because, you know, I have to know every single day where I am in all of these steps, you know. And for me, I have to be on the first step every day, you know. And that thing that you guys read at the beginning of this, sometimes that's my mantra in the morning, you know, because it's when I say, you know, I must have this, you know. And so for me, that's like a daily surrender every morning, you know, that says I'm an alcoholic and this is my solution, you know. And I have to do that every day. I can't just talk about my first step as, you know, what it was like when I got here, because I've been here, you know, I've been coming to meetings for 41 years and I've been sober for 37 years. And I could stand up here and talk to you about the first step, you know, and probably make it sound really good, but really the first step is personal to me, you know, and it still matters to me every day, you know, and I need to have that acknowledgement every day, you know. And then, you know, I also need to make that, you know, not only the admission of powerlessness, but the surrender that, you know, says that, you know, not only can I not do it, but I need to have a power greater than myself that, you know, and I need to take that into my day, you know. So I have this, you know, sort of silent morning practice that I do. Sometimes if I forget to do it before I get out of bed, I'll do it when I'm in the car. But I always have to do it, because if I don't acknowledge that I'm an alcoholic every single day, you know, heaven help me, you know. So, you know, I mean, I've seen a lot of things over the years that I've been coming in. I've seen a lot of people come and go, and people come and go for what appears to be different reasons, you know, and the circumstances may be different, but it's kind of like the circumstances of our drinking. They may be different, but we're all the same here, you know, we're all just alcoholics, you know. And I think that, you know, this is just my opinion and my observation, but I think that people who don't stay here, they don't stay here because they've lost their connection, you know. I think that, you know, you know, I've seen people who are absolutely, you know, staunch atheists, you know, stay sober, but they have some form of a higher power that they are connected to. What, you know, they may not call it spiritual, they may not call it God, but they have a connection with a power greater than themselves that they've reconciled with. And you know, and then I've seen people come in and talk about God, you know, like they're best friends, you know, and then the next thing you know, they're out the door, you know. So what's the difference? The difference is the connection, you know, making that connection. And I think that that is what I call an essential ingredient, you know. So I have this this theory, you know, that everybody thinks that there's sort of a I don't know, a recipe for sobriety. You know, like you got to do this and you got to do that. And everybody has a different idea of what that is. You know, whether it's go to lots of meetings, you know, you hear meeting makers make it. Well, sure they do, as long as they're doing all the other things too, you know. And you know, you have to have a higher power. Well, yes, but you also have to go to meetings. You know, you can't just stay sober on get hitting your knees every day. That's great and it's important. And that's also one element, you know. So to me, it's not 30% this and 20% that and 10% that. It's 100%, you know, prayer or whatever it is that you do to connect with your higher power, whatever that looks like for you. You know, it's going to meetings, it's being of service, it's helping another alcoholic, it's doing step work. And so it's 100% of those things, not 20% of each, you know. And so if you're doing all of those things, if you're active and you're doing all those things in your daily life, you're setting yourself up for success here. The trick is to keep doing it, you know, because it's really easy when you've been coming for a long time to get complacent, you know. And I think, you know, people say that, I don't know, what's the thing? Something is the enemy of the great. What's the expression? The good is the enemy of the great. Yeah, well, I think that complacency is the enemy of sobriety, you know. And so, you know, it's not that you're not doing it right. It's that you're not doing it, you know. And you know, I mean, people say, oh, you know, I went to AA, and you know, because there's not really a wrong way. You just have to do it. You know what I mean? And I mean, it's funny, but it's not funny because, you know, it's like, yeah, I could talk to you about it, but until you experience it, you know, until you stop doing it and you experience what I did when I stopped doing it, I don't want that for any of you. You know, so if you're smart or if you're lucky or if you're vigilant, as I like to say, you don't have to, you know. And that's why we share our experience so we can learn from, you know, each other and, you know, what to do and also what not to do. You know, I think sometimes the stories of what not to do can be just as important. And for me, it's just, you know, becoming indifferent and, you know, and complacent and just thinking, you know. And I've watched people come and go, and I've seen people, you know, I had a good friend who, you know, Billy and I let him sleep on our couch for a while, and he had a lot of sobriety, and then he went out on like painkillers or something and just couldn't get back. Couldn't get back. You know, he tried really hard. He'd get little bits. He just couldn't stay. And one day, you know, Billy was trying to help him, and he was his mother had gotten an apartment for him, and so Billy was helping him to move into it. And he said, "You know, you look bad. Let me take you to the hospital." And he said, "Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing." You know, and he was dead like 2 days later. So, you know, I mean, that's, you know, those words, you know, I've got this, or I know what I'm doing, or what some people like to say, you know, which always, you know, gives me chills is, I'm not worried about drinking. You know, people say, you know, and I get the whole, you know, people say about the drinking, it's about the thinking and things like that. There's all kinds of expressions out there that people say, you know, but to me, it is about the drink, you know. I'm an alcoholic, you know, and when I don't have a solution here, then, you know, alcohol is always going to look like a solution, you know. It's still out there in a shiny bottle, you know, waiting for me, you know, and calling my name. It's like a wolf trying to separate me from the pack, you know, so that it can kill me. So I stay in the middle. I stay in the middle of the pack because I'm not willing to give up my sobriety. But yeah, I think that you know, and I've shared this in meetings before, and I don't know, people may beg to differ and argue with me on it, and that's fine. You know, like I said, everything I say here is my opinion or my experience or both. You know, I just think that you know, if you think that it's not about the drink or you're not worried about drinking if you do this or you do that, or you don't have, you know, a plan in place to sort of protect yourself against that, or, you know, no, losing my words, I knew it would happen. Yeah, I told you it was going to happen, didn't I, Lynn? Losing my words. You know, I mean, there's a reason why we have safeguards. There's, you know, like we're coming into the holiday season, and people have got to go to their family parties, I mean, I'm fortunate to be in a family where I've got a lot of recovery, and I don't, drinking is not really, I'm not really not surrounded by it, I mean, like my one sister who's not in AA might bring a bottle of wine to my daughter's house for Christmas Day, and they might drink that, but I'm surrounded by people who are sober or who, understand and want to protect my sobriety, but not everybody has that, And so, I used to go to this meeting, and they would have the guy who, would open the meeting at this time of the year. He would always do this, what he called a public service announcement, and he would say, if you're going to a party, drive yourself, so you have a way out. Make sure you have phone numbers in your pocket. This was before cell phones, but I mean, yes, my sobriety predates cell phones, but make sure that you have, things that you can do if you reach a point, because there's comes a time, and I've heard this since the very beginning. There will come a time in your sobriety where the only thing that stands between, where opportunity and desire will meet, opportunity and desire, and the only thing that stands between you and a drink is your higher power, and sometimes, that can look like I have my sponsor's phone number, as one of my favorites on my phone, and it's in my pocket, that's me taking my higher power into a meeting, into a party, or I know that my car is parked on the street in a way that it's not going to get blocked in. So if I need to make a quick exit, I have a plan. This isn't me just putting it out there to God. This is me saying, okay, God, I know you have my back, but I'm going to put these safeguards into place. I'm going to make these choices. I'm going to take these actions that are going to prevent me from, being in a situation that I can't get myself out of. Because when I was drinking, I was notorious for being in situations I couldn't get myself out of. I used to have to bring my sister with me as a babysitter because she knew that I was going to leave with the meanest, ugliest, most inappropriate guy at the party, if I didn't have somebody to prevent that, or if I was heading to the bathroom, she would go with me to the bathroom because she knew if I didn't, she was going to have to, I was going to come out with puke in my hair. I mean, there's just no, I mean, I was, puking, blackout, sloppy, wildly inappropriate drunk. And boy, am I grateful not to have that life today. Why am I grateful? I mean, anyway, this is the time of night where I start to lose my words, and I know it's 10 of, and I was going to really try for like, five of, but I think I'm going to wrap it up because, otherwise I'll just blather on, and that's not really necessary. I think I've given all the messages that I have for tonight, and I'm so glad to be here, and I'm so, I'm always, always, always grateful for opportunity to be a service. So don't hesitate to ask for me to come back in another, let's not make it 20 years this time. Maybe a couple of years. But anyway, you guys don't know how lucky you are to have this guy. I mean, he works so hard for you guys so you guys can have a good meeting. So thank you, Billy. And thank you all for listening. That's enough out of me.